Stalkers. He flipped it open. There are only two summaries in here. Am I one of them? No. I imagine you would be filed under Bitch Ex-Wife. The first summary is for Harry Sleznik. According to this, Sleznik is a self-described separatist who seceded from the United States and declared his townhouse a sovereign country. He was arrested when he tried to annex his neighbor's garage. Dicky quit the case after being paid in Sleznik dollars. The last piece of paper attached to this is a formal declaration of war against Dicky. The second nut is Bernard Gross.
I know him, I told Ranger. He's a world's strongest man wannabe. Vinny bonded him out on a domestic violence charge and he went FTA. I found him in a gym and when I got him outside, he freaked and wrecked my car. He got his hands under the frame and flipped it over like a turtle.
Dicky represented him in his divorce, at least initially.
While deposing Gross, the subject of gynecomastia came up. Dicky made the fatal mistake of referring to them as man boobs, and Gross destroyed the conference room in a fit of steroid-induced rage. Apparently, Gross is sensitive about his gynecomastia.
Something to remember. Do you think either of these guys is crazy enough to steal Dicky?
Ranger handed the file back to me.
I can see them stealing him. I can't see them keeping him.
The office next to Pediac was occupied by someone who actually did work there, probably the firm's finance officer. I downloaded a bunch of files onto a flash drive, but I'm not sure I have the software on my computer to read them, spreadsheets and things. I was hoping you could open it.
Ranger turned the key in the ignition and gave the Cayenne some gas.
What should we do with your hitchhiker? Do you want to let her tag along, or do you want me to get rid of her?
I turned and looked out the back window. Joyce was behind us in a white Taurus, no doubt a rental.
She must have picked me up when I left my apartment. You can let her follow. It'll kill her when we drive into the rangeman garage.
We were in Ranger's office attached to the rangeman control room. Ranger was relaxed in his chair with a stack of reports in front of him.
When Ziggy Zerbar went missing, I ran Dicky and his partners through the system, Ranger said. Credit reports, real estate, personal history, litigation. They look clean on the surface, but you put them together and it feels off. Smullen spends a lot of time out of country. Gorvich is a Russian immigrant. Pediak was military, did a couple Middle East tours and got out. Smullen, Gorvich, and Pediak all look like they bought their law degrees a couple years ago, and they all lived in Sheepshead Bay before moving here.
So maybe they were getting together for Monday night football and decided they'd become lawyers and move to Trenton.
Yeah. Ranger said. That would work.
Here's something weird. It's been 4 days since Dicky was dragged out of his house, leaving a trail of blood. Ordinarily, the chances of death increase with length of disappearance, but for some reason, the longer this goes on, the more I believe Dicky is alive. Probably just wishful thinking since I'm the prime murder suspect.
I think Dicky and his partners were involved in bad business, and something happened that made the deal start to unravel. Ziggy Zerbar seems to be the first victim.
Dicky appears to be the second. And now houses are getting tossed and Smullen has contacted you and Joyce. We don't really know what happened at Dicky's house. We have gunshots fired and evidence indicating someone getting dragged out of the house. DNA testing hasn't come back yet on the blood, so we aren't sure who got shot. It's possible Dicky is in the wind and someone is scrambling to find him. It's also possible he's dead and he had something that wasn't recovered before he died.
Like the 40 million, I said.
Yes.
What else do we know about the partners?
All three partners are in their early 50s. Pediak moved into the area 5 years ago, and Gorvich and Smullen followed. Pediak owns a modest house in Mercerville. Gorvich and Smullen are renting a large garden apartment complex off Clockner Boulevard. Before moving to Trenton, Smullen owned a car wash in Sheepshead Bay. Gorvich had part ownership in a restaurant, and Pediak owned a limo service consisting of one car. Somehow, the three men found Dicky, and between them they managed to buy an office building downtown, an apartment building that sits on the edge of public housing, and a warehouse on Stark Street. No litigation against any of them. Smullen is married, with a wife and children in South America. Gorvich is currently unmarried and has been divorced 3 times, and Pediak has never married.
Ranger plugged the flash drive into his computer, opened a spreadsheet, and broke into a smile.
You downloaded the firm's financial records. Clients, fees for service, service provided. There's a separate spreadsheet for each partner.
I dragged my chair next to his so I could see the screen as he scrolled down.
Dicky has normal clients and is pulling in around 200,000, Ranger said after a half hour of reading.
Smullen, Pediak, and Gorvich have client lists that read like who's who in hell. South American drug lords, gunrunners, mercenaries, and some local thugs. And they're billing big money.
I'd been taking notes and doing a tally in my head as we moved from one partner to the next, and I had a grip on how much money we were talking about.
$40 million and change, I said. Now we know who owned the Smith-Barney money. We just don't know where it went.
Ranger gathered the reports together, slid them into a large envelope, and handed them over to me.
This is your copy. I'll have my financial guy go over the material on the flash drive and summarize it for us.
He looked at his watch.
I have to get to the airport. I'm flying to Miami to escort a high-bond FTA back to Jersey. I should be home tomorrow night. I'll call when I get in. Tank will be available if you have problems.
Chapter 9.
Okay, so run this by me again, Lula said. We're all dressed up like Handy Andy for why?
Dickie is part owner of an apartment building. On the odd chance that he isn't dead, I thought it might be a place he'd hole up. Or maybe a place someone would hold him hostage. It's on Jewel Street, right on the edge of public housing. I did a drive-by and it looks like a candidate for urban renewal. There are 10 units and I'm sure they all have leaky faucets and broken toilets. I figure we go in looking like maintenance and we won't have a problem poking around.
I hope you realize I could be shopping right now. There's a big shoe sale at Macy's.
Yes, but since you're with me going on a crime-solving adventure, you get to wear this neat tool belt. It's got a hammer and a tape measure and a screwdriver.
Where'd you get this thing anyway? It don't hardly fit a full-figure woman like me.
Borrowed it from my building super, Dylan Rudick. I parked the Cayenne next to a dumpster in the alley behind the building. Joyce was still following me, but I didn't care a whole lot as long as she stayed in her rental car and didn't interfere. We'll start at the bottom and work our way to the top, I told Lula. It shouldn't take long.
Just suppose we find this dickhead, then what? It's not like he committed a crime. It's not like he's FTA and we can haul his bony ass off to jail.
I guess we sit on him and call the Trenton Times to come over with a photographer.
I would have worn something different if I'd known that. I got a sweatshirt and baggy-ass jeans on, so I look handy. This isn't going to show me off in a photograph. And look at my hair. Do I have time to change my hair color? I photograph much better when I'm blonde.
I opened the back door to the building and peered into the dark interior. It was a 3-story walk-up with a center stairway. 4 apartments on the first floor, 4 on the second, and 2 on the third. It was late afternoon. Coming up to dinner time, most tenants would be at home. I knocked on 1A and a Hispanic woman answered. I told her we were checking toilet seals.
Toilet don't work, the woman said. No toilet.
What do you mean it don't work? You gotta have a toilet, Lula said.
Don't work.
Lula elbowed her way in.
Maybe we can fix it. Let me have a look at this toilet. Sometimes you just gotta jiggle the handle.
The apartment consisted of 1 large room opening off a galley kitchen, plus a single bedroom and bathroom. 7 kids and 6 adults were watching a small television in the living room. A big pot of something vaguely smelling like chili bubbled on the stove. Lula wedged herself into the little bathroom and stood in front of the toilet.
This toilet looks okay to me, Lula said. What's wrong with it?
Don't work.
Lula flushed the toilet. Nothing. She picked the lid up and looked inside.
There's no water in this toilet, she said. That's your problem.
Lula reached around and turned the valve on the pipe leading to the toilet.
It's going to work just fine now, she said.
She flushed the toilet again, and the bowl began to fill with water. The Hispanic woman was waving her arms and talking rapid-fire Spanish.
What's she saying? Lula asked me.
I shrugged. I don't speak Spanish.
You're with Ranger all the time. Don't he ever speak Spanish?
Yes, but I don't know what he says. The toilet bowl was now entirely filled with water, and the water was still running.
Uh-oh, Lula said. Maybe I should shut the water off.
She reached behind the toilet, turned the valve, and it came off in her hand.
Huh, she said. This ain't good.
Don't work, the Hispanic woman said. Don't work, don't work.
The water was running over the side of the toilet bowl, splashing onto the floor.
We got to go now, Lula said to the woman, giving her the handle to the valve. And don't worry, we're going to put this on our report. You'll be hearing from someone.
Lula closed the apartment door behind her and headed for the stairs.
Maybe we should skip right to the second floor, she said.
Don't offer to fix anything this time, I said, and let me do the talking.
I was just trying to be helpful is all. I saw right off her problem was she didn't have the water turned on.
She didn't have it turned on because the valve was broken.
She didn't communicate that to me, Lula said.
I knocked on the door to 2A, and my knock was answered by a little black woman with short-cropped gray hair.
"We're checking to see if there are any maintenance issues with this building," I told her.
"I don't have any problems," the woman said. "Thank you for asking."
"How about your toilet?" Lula said. "Does your toilet work okay?"
"Yes, my toilet is fine."
I thanked the woman and pushed Lula away from the door, over to 2B.
"I know something's wrong here," Lula said, sniffing the air. "Smells like a gas leak. Good thing we're going around checking on these things."
"We're not checking on anything. We're looking for Dickie."
"Sure, I know that," Lula said. "That don't mean we can't detect a gas leak."
The door was answered by a fat guy wearing boxer shorts.
"What do you want?"
he asked.
"We've been sent by the gas company," Lula said. "We smelled a leak."
She stuck her head into his apartment.
"Yeah, it's coming from in here, all right."
"There's no gas in here," he said. "Everything's electric."
"I guess I know gas when I smell it," Lula said. "My partner and me are from the gas company. We know these things. How about the oven? Are you sure the oven isn't gas?"
"What do you think this is, the Hotel Ritz? The oven don't even work. The oven never worked. I gotta cook everything in the microwave."
Lula pushed past him.
"Stephanie, you go walk around and make sure there's no gas leaking out of anything."
I stepped in and gasped at the stench. I looked at the fat guy, and I was pretty sure I knew what was leaking gas, but I held my breath and did a fast run through the apartment to make sure Dickie's corpse wasn't rotting in the bathtub.
"This place reeks," Lula said to the fat guy. "What are you cooking in that microwave?"
"Bean burritos. That's all it cooks. It explodes everything else."
"Guess we found the gas source," Lula said. "And you should put a shirt on. It should be illegal for you to go without a shirt."
"What about my microwave? Are you gonna fix it? It explodes everything."
"We're from the gas company," Lula said. "We don't do microwaves."
"You got a tool belt on," the guy said. "You're supposed to fix things, and I want my microwave fixed."
"Okay, okay," Lula said. "Let me take a look here."
"Careful of the door," he said. "It sticks."
"That's probably your problem. It takes you too long to get the door open, and then you cook everything too long, and it explodes."
Lula gave the door a good hard yank. A couple screws flew off into space, the hinges snapped, and the door came off in her hand.
"Oops," Lula said.
I didn't waste any time getting out of there. I was halfway up the stairs to the third floor when I heard Lula slam the door on 2B and come pounding after me.
"Least he won't be stinking things up eating more of them microwave burritos," Lula said.
My cell phone rang. It was Tank.
"Are you okay?"
he asked. "Yep," Tank disconnected.
"Who was that?"
Lula wanted to know. "Ranger's out of town and Tank's in charge of my safety."
"I thought I was in charge of your safety."
"I'll tell him next time he calls." I rapped on 3A. A tall black guy with red dreads answered the door.
"Holy cow," Lula said. "It's Uncle Mickey."
"Your uncle?"
"No, Uncle Mickey's gently used cars. He's famous. He does those commercials on television. Come to Uncle Mickey's gently used cars and we'll treat you right. Everybody knows Uncle Mickey."
"What can I do for you girls?" Uncle Mickey asked. "Are you looking for a deal on a car?"
"No, we're the Fix-It sisters," Lula said. "We're going around fixing things."
I did a mental eye roll. We were more like the Broke-It sisters.
"What are you doing in a dump like this?" Lula asked Uncle Mickey.
"Not as much profit margin as you'd expect in used cars," Mickey said. "Uncle Mickey's fallen on some hard times. Got a lot of overhead. Had a bad run with the ponies."
He peeked out into the hall.
"You aren't going to tell anyone Uncle Mickey lives here, are you?"
"You living here by yourself?"
"Yeah, just Uncle Mickey all by himself in the penthouse. I don't suppose you girls would like to come in and entertain Uncle Mickey."
"We got work to do," Lula said. "You're gonna have to entertain yourself."
Uncle Mickey disappeared behind his door, and we moved to 3B.
"That was sort of depressing," Lula said. "He looked so sincere in those commercials. You just want to rush out and buy one of his cars."
A voluptuous, dark-haired, dark-eyed woman answered my knock at 3B. She was wearing a red sweater and jeans and had an expensive watch on her wrist and a diamond cocktail ring that went knuckle to knuckle. I put her age at 40 with very good jeans.
"Yes," she said.
"We're working our way through college fixing things," Lula said. "You got anything broken?"
"I know who you are,"
the woman said to me.
"I saw your picture in the paper. You're the woman who murdered Dickie R."
"I didn't murder him," I said. "I have an alibi."
"Yeah, right. Everyone's always got an alibi. You're in big trouble. Or embezzled a shitload of money from the firm, and you killed a little worm before anyone could figure out where he put it."
"How do you know that?"
"The guy I'm living with is a partner, Peter Smullen. He tells me everything. We're getting married as soon as he gets a divorce from his bitch wife. Then we can buy a house and get out of this dump."
Peter Smullen lives here?
Usually, when he's not traveling or screwing around. He didn't come home last night, and it's gonna cost him big. I've had my eye on a bracelet at Tiffany's. I've been waiting for him to pull something like this.
A woman's gotta plan ahead, Lula said. Gotta take advantage of those opportunities.
Fucking A,
Smullen's girlfriend said. Okay then, I said. Have a nice day. We'll be moving along.
Lula and I stopped on the second floor landing.
That was interesting, Lula said. Do you want to try the other tenants? We missed a bunch on the first and second floors.
I don't think Dickie is here, but we might as well finish the job we started. And for God's sake, don't offer to fix anything.
Joyce followed me to my apartment building and parked two rows back. I could be a good person and tell her I was done for the night, or I could be mean and let her sit here for a while before she figured it out. I decided to go with mean. She wouldn't believe me anyway. I took the elevator to the second floor and found a guy in Rangeman Black waiting in front of my door.
I'm supposed to make sure your apartment is safe before you go in, he said.
Good grief. I guess I appreciated the concern, but this was feeling a little over the top. I unlocked the door and waited while he did his thing, looking under beds and checking out closets.
Sorry, he said when he was done. Tank made me do it. If something happens to you while Ranger's away, we're all out of a job.
Ranger should get a grip.
Yes, ma'am.
I closed the door and looked at him through the peephole. He was still standing there. I opened the door. Now what? I said.
I'm not allowed to leave until I hear you lock and bolt the door.
I closed the door, locked and bolted it. I looked through the peephole again. No range man. I hung my coat and bag on the hook in the hall and gave Rex a cracker. I have a very strange life, I said to Rex. I got a beer out of the fridge and called Morelli's cell phone.
What?
Morelli said. I just wanted to say hello.
I can't talk now. I'll call you later.
Sure. He won't call, I said to Rex. Men are like that. I tried Ranger's cell and got his answering service. You're a nut, I told him. I took the envelope filled with reports into the living room and began reading through the material. There was nothing in any of the reports to link Smullen, Gorvitch, and Pettiak together other than their previous address, and that connection was vague. They were all from different neighborhoods in Sheepshead Bay. Ranger had checked not just Smullen, Gorvitch, and Pettiak, but their parents as well. All families seemed to be hard-working and clean, no criminal records anywhere, no indication of mob connection. Gorvitch was Russian-born, but immigrated with his parents when he was 12. There was also nothing to link Smullen, Gorvitch, and Pettiak to Dickie prior to their entering into business together.
Chapter 10. I woke up on the couch with Pettiak's credit report clutched in my hand and sun streaming in through the two living room windows. The bad part was I had a crick in my neck from sleeping on the couch all night. The good part was I was already dressed. I went to the kitchen and started coffee brewing. I poured out a bowl of cereal and added milk, saying a silent thank you to Morelli. It had been thoughtful of him to bring food, and I was sure he would have called back last night if it had been at all possible. I felt my eyes narrow and my blood pressure rise a little thinking about the phone call I never got, and made an effort at composure. He was busy. He was working. He was Italian. Yada, yada, yada. I finished the cereal, poured myself a cup of coffee, and took it to the living room window. I looked down into the parking lot. No white Taurus. Mr. Warnick walked out of the building and got into his vintage Cadillac. He was wearing a sports jacket and tie, all dressed up for church. He didn't look cold. The sky was blue, the sun was shining, birds were chirping. Spring had sneaked in while I was asleep on the couch. My head was filled with miscellaneous facts about Smullen, Gorvitch, and Pettiak. They were all mediocre students in high school. Pettiak went to a state college on a military scholarship. Smullen and Gorvitch went to colleges that were unfamiliar to me. None of the men had been involved in varsity sports. Smullen had a sweet tooth. Gorvitch collected wives but didn't keep them. Smullen had a wife in South America and a girlfriend in a slum in Trenton. Smullen had arranged a meeting with me but didn't show. He'd also done a no-show on his girlfriend. I had bad vibes on Smullen. I was afraid something had gone down, and it hadn't been good for Smullen. Next up was a visit to Grandma. Unfortunately, all Rangeman vehicles are equipped with a tracking device. Between the bug in my purse and the transmitter in the Porsche, Rangeman knew my every move, and the guys were on high Stephanie alert until Ranger returned.
I wanted to take a look at the warehouse this morning, and I didn't want to attract a lot of attention. I didn't want five guys in Rangeman Black hovering around the structure, wondering if they should break in SWAT style. So I was going to leave my purse and Ranger's Porsche at my parents' house and take Uncle Sandor's Buick. Uncle Sandor gave Grandma his 53 powder blue and white Roadmaster Buick when he went into the nursing home. It's a classic car in cherry condition, and it's eerily indestructible. Men think it's a very cool car, but if I had my choice, I'd go with a red Ferrari. I drove the Cayenne to my parents' house and popped inside. I'm going to borrow the Buick, I told Grandma. I'll bring it back in a couple hours.
You could drive it all you want. It almost never gets used.
I got behind the wheel of the monstrous Buick and cranked the V8 over. I put it into reverse and backed it out of the garage and onto the street. The car rumbled under me, sucking gas and spewing toxins. I shoved it into drive and muscled it out of the burg. I took Hamilton to Broad and cut through the center of town. The warehouse Dickie partly owns is on Stark Street. Stark Street starts bad and gets worse. The early blocks are marginal businesses mixed with slum housing. Shady entrepreneurial private enterprise flourishes on this part of Stark,
where you can buy everything from shoplifted Banana Republic t-shirts to the drug of your choice to a backseat BJ.
It's a long street, and the further you travel, the more the street gives over to anger and despair. Squatters live in the graffiti-riddled condemned buildings of Middle Stark. And finally, Stark turns to scrub fields and the skeletal remains of factories that are too wasted to draw even gang interest.
Beyond this moonscape of scorched brick rubble, at the very end of Stark, just past the salvage graveyard, is a light industrial park.
The rent is cheap, and the access to Route 1 is excellent. Dickie's warehouse was in this industrial park. I turned onto Stark and had the road to myself. Sunday morning, and everyone was sleeping off Saturday night. Good thing, too, because at another time I would have attracted attention in the Buick. I drove past the junkyard and into the small industrial park. It was dead quiet. The warehouse was next to an automotive paint and body shop. No cars parked in the warehouse lot, but there were a couple cars in the body shop lot. I docked the Buick next to one of the cars in the body shop. Just in case someone happened by, I didn't want to make it obvious I was in the warehouse. The body shop was closed up tight, but I could hear a power tool being used inside. The diode on a security camera over a door blinked from red to green. I was being filmed. Probably worked on a motion sensor. I was debating moving the Buick when the door opened and a huge, tattooed, wild-haired guy stepped out.
"Now what?" he said. "I'm clean!"
It was Randy Sklar. He'd gotten busted for possession about 6 months ago. Vinny had bonded him out and he'd failed to appear. I found him in a bar drunk off his ass, and Lula and I had literally dragged him back to the police station. Only one reason for Randy Sklar to be up and working on a Sunday morning. This was a chop shop, and Randy was taking a car apart. You don't let a hot car sit. You take a torch to it, and in a couple hours the evidence is gone, and the parts are shipped out. I smiled at Randy, because before he passed out and I slapped the cuffs on him, he'd been fun at the bar. And I was also smiling because this was a stroke of luck. Randy wasn't going to call the police if I broke into the warehouse. He was going to keep his bay doors down and locked and hope no one wanted to talk to him. "I'm not looking for you," I told him. "I heard you managed to wiggle out of the possession charge."
"Yeah, there were some problems with police procedure. Are you looking to get rid of the Buick?"
"No, I just want to park here while I go next door."
"Not much over there," Randy said.
"Looked to me like they cleaned house."
"I'm looking for the guy who owns it."
"Don't know nothing about that. Just know trucks come in and out at night while we're working. Figured it was a mob running a hijacking op, so we stayed away. Like to keep a low profile anyway. Then, a couple days ago, there's non-stop activity. And from what I could see through the open bays, the place got emptied out. And no one's been there since. At least no trucks."
"Cars?"
"Haven't seen any, but they could park on the side. There's a door over there. Looks like there are offices on the second floor."
"So how's life?"
"Life's okay. You should come back to the bar. I'll buy you a drink."
"That's a deal." I crossed a small patch of blighted grass and circled the warehouse. Four loading docks in the back. Windows at the upper level. A locked front door. And a locked side door. If I was with Ranger, this wouldn't be a problem. There was a frosted window and vent on a back corner. Bathroom. I could break the window and climb in. probably set off a security alarm, but I'd have at least 20 minutes before anyone would respond to this location, and chances were decent no one would come at all. I went back to the Buick and got a tire iron out of the trunk. I whacked the window with a tire iron and cleaned out the glass as best I could. I carefully crawled through the window with minimum damage, a scrape on my arm and a tear in my jeans. I was in a bathroom that was best used in the dark. I held my breath and tiptoed out. I'd soak my shoes in Clorox when I got home. I flipped a switch and overhead fluorescents blinked on. Randy was right. The warehouse had been swept clean. Not a scrap of garbage anywhere, other than in the bathroom. Lots of empty shelves, a couple long folding tables, some folding chairs neatly stacked against a wall. No hint as to the use other than a lingering odor of something chemical, gasoline or kerosene. There was a freight elevator and an enclosed stairwell servicing a second floor. I very quietly took the stairs. The door was closed at the top. I opened the door and found another empty storage area. An office with a large, smudged, frosted window looked out at the storeroom. I looked more closely and realized the window was dark with soot. This got my heart to flop around a little in my chest. I tried the door. Locked. I took a deep breath and used the tire iron on the office window. I looked inside the office, and it took a moment to figure it out. Sometimes things are so ghastly, it takes time for your mind to catch up with your eye. I was looking at a cadaver sitting in a chair behind a desk. The desk, the chair, the body, and the wall behind it were scorched black, all burned to a crisp. It was so terrible, so far removed from reality, that at first there was no emotional reaction other than disbelief. I was at the broken window looking into the room, and the room smelled like smoke and charred flesh. I'd like to think I was good in an emergency, but the truth is, instinct takes over, and it doesn't always lead to intelligent action. The moment I smelled the fire, I went completely spastic. My only thought was to get as far away as possible, as fast as possible. I tumbled through the door, all flailing arms and frantic legs, and I slid down 5 stairs before getting my footing. I was about to open the ground floor door when there was a sound like a giant pilot light igniting.
Foomph!
I opened the stairwell door to a wall of flame and more spastic horror. I slammed the door shut and ran back up the stairs. There were no windows in the storeroom, only windows in the torched office. I scrambled over broken glass into the office, opened a window on the outside wall, and looked down. I was at least 30 feet off the ground. So here was a choice. I could dive headfirst and splatter like Humpty Dumpty, or I could stay in the building and burn like the guy at the desk. Randy came running from the body shop. "Jump!" he yelled at me. "It's too far!" A second guy came running.
"Holy shit," he said. "What's she doing up there?"
"Get the truck," Randy said to the guy. "Hurry!" Flames were starting to lick up the side of the building, and the floor was hot under my feet. An 18-wheeler rolled out of the body shop over the grass and idled at the front of the warehouse. "He's gonna drive it under you and you need to jump fast before it catches fire," Randy yelled at me. Okay, so it was a little Hollywood. Doesn't mean it wouldn't work, and it's not like I had a lot of options. I straddled the open window, the truck moved in, I swung my other leg over, sucked in some air, and jumped. I hit the metal roof feet first and lost my balance. I went to hands and knees looking for something to grip, clawing at air. I slid over the side of the trailer and grabbed a strut as the truck drove away from the building. I hung like that, flopping around and swearing for just a couple seconds before my fingers released, and I crashed to the ground. I was spread eagle on my back with all the air knocked out of me. I had cobweb vision, the truck engine chugging in my ear, and Randy bending over me. His face was inches from mine, the sun framing his wild man of Borneo hair in a glorious corona. I couldn't speak. The air hadn't yet returned to my lungs. "Ugh," I said. "What should I do?" he asked. "Should I feel for broken bones? Maybe around your rib cage. Loosen your clothes." "Ugh." "It was worth a try," he said. "A guy's gotta try, right?"
"I'm assuming I'm not dead."
"No, you're just a little scratched up and..."
"And what?"
"And nothing."
"You're looking at my hair. What's wrong with my hair?"
"It's a little singed."
I closed my eyes. "Shit.
You're not gonna cry, are you? My girlfriend always cries if I say the wrong thing about her hair. I hate that.
I made an effort to get up, but I was in pain everywhere and not making much vertical progress. Finally, Randy got me under the armpits and dragged me to my feet.
I don't suppose you found the guy you were looking for, Randy said.
Hard to tell.
Are you waiting around for the police and the fire trucks?
Do you think they'll come?
Not unless we call them.
I'm not inclined to do that.
Me either.
Thanks for getting me out of there, I said to Randy.
That was a really big truck.
It's a double-decker car hauler. We use it to, haul cars.
The warehouse was an inferno, completely engulfed in flames, the heat stinging my skin. Black smoke billowed about a quarter mile into the sky.
It's a decent fire, Randy said, looking up at the smoke. We might get some action on this one.
I limped to the Buick, managed to get behind the wheel, and did some slow breathing. I sat for a couple minutes, collecting myself. A bay door to the body shop opened, and the car hauler rolled out. The shop had cleaned up for visitors. I got the Buick started and followed the hauler to Route 1. Sirens screamed in the distance, but we were traveling away from them. When we reached Route 1, the hauler went north, and I went south. I took the Broad Street exit and drove back to my apartment. Ranger's Porsche and my purse were still at my parents' house, but I wasn't going to retrieve them looking like this. I'd lost about an inch of hair, and the ends were scorched black and frizzed. I was cut and scraped and blistered and sore. I was going to take a shower and crawl into bed and stay there until my hair grew back. I stepped out of the elevator and slowly propelled myself down the hall, leaving smudges of soot and blood. Before the day was over, Dylan would be working on the carpet with his rug shampooer. Mental note, get a six-pack for Dylan. I opened my door, trudged inside, and almost keeled over when I saw Ranger. He was sitting in my living room in my only good chair, his elbows on the arms, his fingers steepled together in front of him. His face showed no emotion, but he was radiating anger. I could have popped corn on the invisible energy Ranger was throwing. Don't start, I said to him.
Do you need a doctor?
I need a shower. His eyebrows raised ever so slightly. No, I said. I limped into the bathroom and whimpered when I saw my reflection in the mirror. I closed the door and dropped my clothes on the floor. Lucky for me, the weather was still cool, and I'd been wearing a heavy sweatshirt and jeans. The clothes saved most of my skin from the broken glass. I washed away the grime and a lot of the blood. I slapped some band-aids over the deeper gashes, got dressed in clean clothes, and went out to face Ranger.
You got home early, I said.
I had to fly charter. Couldn't get on a commercial plane with my man.
How did you know I wasn't visiting my mom?
Your visits are never that long. Hal got suspicious and called your cell and talked to your grandmother.
I wanted to take a look at the warehouse, and I was afraid I'd be followed by a range man caravan.
He didn't say anything to that. If you didn't know Ranger, you would think he looked relaxed in the chair, one long leg extended, one bent at the knee, arms on the upholstered armrests. If you knew him at all, you would be extremely wary. I sat across from him on the couch, easing myself down. I leaned my head back and closed my eyes for a moment, struggling with composure, not wanting to burst into tears in front of Ranger. I opened my eyes and blew out a sigh, because he was still there, watching me.
I assume you burned the warehouse down, Ranger finally said.
It wasn't my bad. I think someone set a bomb and I got caught.
Anyone else in there?
A dead guy. He was sitting behind a desk on the second floor. Looked like he'd been toasted with a flamethrower. I only know flamethrowers from movies and the 6 o'clock news, but that's what it looked like to me.
The body was burned beyond recognition. It was awful. Both Dickie and Smullen are missing. I suppose it could have been one of them. No way to know for sure. I was leaving when the building caught. I was in the stairwell. Something went phoomph, and then there was fire everywhere. I had to go back up to the office and jump out the window. That's the short version.
Did anyone see you there?
No one we need to worry about.
You should pass this on to Morelli so they know to look for the body.
I'll pass it on, but trust me, there's no body left.
What kind of shape are you in? Ranger asked. Are you functioning? We still got Stuart Hansen on ice at Range Man.
You can bring him in now and no one will associate you with the cannabis farm house fire.
He won't tell anyone?
I don't think he'll remember, Ranger said.
and if he does say something, I doubt anyone will believe him. We've been keeping him very happy.
Do you have him drugged?
Quality weed, Ella's cooking, and nonstop television on a 50-inch plasma.
Ranger stood and pulled me to my feet.
Would you rather do this tomorrow?
No, I'll be okay.
You don't look okay. You've got blood soaking through your jeans.
I looked down at my leg. I should have used a bigger Band-Aid.
Do you need stitches?
No, it's just a cut. I had to go through a smashed window to get out of the building.
I'm going to ask you again, do you need stitches?
I didn't know. I hoped not.
Let me see it, Ranger said.
I bit into my lower lip. This was embarrassing.
Babe, I've seen it all, Ranger said.
Yes, but you haven't seen it lately.
Has it changed?
He asked. That got me smiling. No. I popped the snap to my jeans and slid them down. I was wearing a lime green lace thong, which was a lot like wearing nothing. Ranger looked and smiled.
Pretty, he said.
Then his attention moved to the gash in my leg.
I know you don't want to hear this, but it'll heal faster and neater if you get some sutures in it.
We put a washcloth against the cut and wrapped my leg with surgical tape.
Do you have any other injuries that are this serious? He asked.
No, I said. This was the worst. We went to St. Francis Emergency and had a minimal wait. The kids with colds and after-lunch heart attack victims had all been cleared out. There'd only been one Sunday afternoon gang shooting, and he'd been DOA. And it was still early in the day for domestic violence. My leg was pumped full of local anesthesia and stitched. I got salve for the burns on my neck and face, and antiseptic ointment for my other scrapes and cuts. Louise Malinowski was working emergency. I'd gone to school with Louise. She was now married and divorced with two kids and back home living with her mom.
Who's the hot guy out there? She asked, helping me get my jeans up over my numb leg and new stitches.
Carlos Manoso. He owns a security agency downtown.
Is he married?
He's as unmarried as a man can get. Ranger watched me buckle myself in. We'd left a Buick in my lot and taken his Porsche Turbo. It was black and new and fast, just like all his other cars, but even more so. Where do all these new black cars come from? I asked him.
I have a deal. I provide services for cars.
What sort of services?
Whatever is required.
He put the car in gear and pulled away from the hospital.
I'm going to take you to your parents' house so you can get your purse, and I want you to call Morelli.
Not something I was looking forward to. This wasn't going to make Morelli happy.
What?
Morelli said when he answered the phone, not sounding especially mellow. How's it going?
It's going not fast enough. What's up?
Did you hear about the fire at the warehouse on Stark?
No. I don't hear about anything. I'm locked away babysitting a moron, and I'm looking at an episode of Raymond that I've seen 42 times.
Dickie and his partners owned a warehouse on Stark, and...
Oh, Christ,
Morelli said.
Don't tell me.
It burned down, just now.
Are you okay?
Yeah, Ranger took me to get stitches. There was silence on the other end, and I imagined Morelli was staring down at his shoe with his lips pressed tight together. Anyway, I'm fine, I told him. I just got cut on some glass when I had to break a window to get out. Is it okay to talk on your cell phone like this? I mean, no one can listen, can they?
Everyone can listen, Morelli said. Don't let that stop you. Is this conversation going to get worse?
If you're going to give me attitude about this, I'm not going to talk to you. I looked over at Ranger, caught him smiling, and punched him in the arm. No one saw me, I said to Morelli. I left before the fire trucks arrived, and it wasn't my fault. I'm pretty sure someone set a bomb. The thing is, there was a guy sitting behind a desk on the second floor, and I think he'd been toasted with a flamethrower. I doubt there's much left of him after the second fire, but Ranger wanted me to tell you. This created a lot more silence. Hello, I said.
Give me a moment, Morelli said. I've almost got myself under control.
How much longer are you going to be on this assignment? I asked Morelli.
At least 2 more days. Let me talk to Ranger.
I gave Ranger my phone. Morelli wants to talk to you.
Yo,
Ranger said. He did some listening, and he cut his eyes to me.
Understood, he said to Morelli. Don't expect miracles. She's an accident waiting to happen.
Ranger disconnected and handed the phone back to me.
I'm in charge of your well-being.
Morelli should mind his own business.
That's exactly what he's doing. You're a couple. You are his business.
I don't feel like his business. I feel like my own business.
No shit, Ranger said.
What was worse, I was caught off guard by the couple status. Do you think Morelli and I are a couple?
He has his clothes in your closet.
Only socks and underwear. Ranger parked in my parents' driveway and turned to face me.
You want to be careful what you tell me. My moral code stops short of do not covet someone else's woman. You've been holding me at arm's length and I respect that. But I'll move in if I feel that barrier relax.
I already knew this, but having it said out loud was disconcerting. I didn't want to make more of it than was necessary, so I tried being playful. Are you telling me socks and underwear are borderline in terms of couple qualifications?
I'm telling you to be careful.
When Ranger issued a warning, he didn't do playful. That's just great, I said. I'm so not good at being careful.
I've noticed, Ranger said.
My grandmother opened the front door and waved. Ranger and I waved back, and I eased myself out of the car and went to retrieve my bag. Is that blood on your pants leg? My grandmother asked when I stepped into the foyer. Kitchen accident, I said. It's fine. Gotta go. Just came in to get my bag. I'll bring the Buick back later. I hurried to the Porsche and angled in.
Barnhart is two houses down and across the street, Ranger said. She was here when we drove up. She must have spotted the Cayenne.
Ranger rolled out of the driveway and down the street. Joyce rolled with us, staying a couple car lengths back.
I'm taking you home with me, Ranger said. I have to catch up on paperwork and meet with Tank, and I don't want to worry about you. You can spend the night and turn Hansen in when the court opens in the morning.
I can't spend the night at Range Man.
Morelli said I should keep you safe.
Yes, but no one's after me. I've just had some unfortunate luck.
Babe, you've destroyed a car, burned down two buildings, stapled a guy's nuts, and you have 16 stitches in your leg. Take a night off, have a glass of wine, watch some television, and go to bed early.
Chapter 11 Ranger's apartment occupies the 7th floor of the Rangeman building. It's professionally decorated in neutral earth tones and classic comfortable furniture. It's cool. It's calm. It's inviting in a mildly masculine way. The carved mahogany front door opens to a long, narrow foyer. Coat closet and powder room on one side, cherrywood credenza on the other. Ranger's housekeeper, Ella, keeps fresh flowers on the credenza, plus a silver tray for keys and mail. Modern kitchen with stainless appliances and granite countertops to the right at the end of the hall. Breakfast bar, small dining room, small living room. The master bedroom suite consists of a den, a bedroom with king bed and smooth white 1,000-thread-count sheets, a dressing room with all black clothes and a weapons cabinet, and a luxurious bathroom with walk-in shower that smells like Ranger's Bulgari green shower gel. Ranger electronically unlocked his apartment door, and I followed him inside. He took an identical lock fob from a drawer in the credenza and gave it to me.
If you decide to leave, take the GPS monitor with you. Hal's bringing the Cayenne back. It'll be parked downstairs with the key on the seat. It's yours for as long as you need it. I'm sure Ella has dinner in the kitchen. Help yourself. I've got a lot to do. I'm going to grab a sandwich downstairs.
He curled his fingers into my sweatshirt, dragged me to him, and kissed me.
If you want to stay up for me, I'll make it worth the wait, he said, his lips barely touching mine when he spoke.
And he was gone. I've lived in Ranger's apartment once before for a short time when my life was in danger. And for a short time, I worked in the Rangeman office. The building felt very safe back then, but after a while, claustrophobic. I prowled through the kitchen and found a chicken stew with rice and vegetables. I scarfed down the stew with a glass of wine and took a second glass into the den to watch television. I sunk into Ranger's big comfy couch and remoted the plasma. Morelli's house was comfortable ground for me. It was filled with hand-me-down furniture left to him by his Aunt Ruth. It looked a lot like my parents' house, and in a strange, unexpected way, the house fit Morelli. When Morelli had time, the house was kept neat and orderly. When Morelli was overworked, the house became cluttered with abandoned shoes and empty beer bottles. Ranger's apartment felt exotic. The furniture was expensive and chosen for Ranger. Very comfortable, but a little sterile. No family photos, no dog-eared books. This was a place where Ranger slept and worked and ate, but didn't live. Morelli's house was a destination for him. Ranger's apartment felt like part of his journey. I probably should have gone home, but the truth is, I love visiting Ranger's apartment. It smells great, like Ranger. His television is bigger and better than mine. He has better water pressure in his shower. His towels are softer and fluffier, and his bed is wonderful, even when he isn't in it. Ella irons his sheets and plumps his pillows. If there is a woman out there who could make me turn, it would be Ella. I fell asleep in front of the television. I woke up at 11 and again at 11:30. I forced myself away from the television and into the bedroom, shucked most of my clothes, and crawled into Ranger's fabulous bed. The alarm jolted me awake, and I had a moment of utter confusion before realizing I was at Range Man. The room was dark, but I could see Ranger outlined against his dressing room light. He crossed the room and stood at bedside to turn the alarm off.
"I have an early meeting with a client this morning," Ranger said, "and I want to talk to you before I get involved in Range Man business. Ella has breakfast on the table."
His cell phone rang, and he left the bedroom. I painfully rolled out of bed, my whole body aching from the fall off the car hauler. I flipped the light on, limped across the room to Ranger's closet, and shrugged into a robe that had been bought for Ranger, but I was sure had never been worn. I couldn't imagine Ranger lounging around in a robe. Ranger's housekeeper Ella was a small, slim woman with intelligent dark eyes, short black hair, and contained energy. Ella's husband managed the property, and Ella managed the men of Range Man. Ella cooked and cleaned and did whatever was necessary to get Ranger out of his apartment each morning in presentable condition. She bought his shower gel, did his laundry, ironed his orgasmic sheets, and set out fresh flowers. The breakfast tray she brought to his door was almost always the same. Coffee, fresh fruit, whole grain bagels, lox, fat-free cream cheese. An egg white frittata with vegetables. Very pretty. Very healthy. This morning, Ella had the dining room table set for two. Ranger ended his call and followed me to the table. He was in corporate attire. Black dress slacks, black dress shirt, black on black striped tie, black gun and holster. He draped a black cashmere sports jacket on an empty dining room chair. He poured coffee while still standing and sat across from me. "Holy cow," I said to him. And I was thinking, "Holy cow."
"I wasn't trying for holy cow," Ranger said. "I was shooting for respectable."
"Good luck with that one," I told him. Ranger was strong inside and out. He was intelligent. He was brave. He was physically and emotionally agile. He was incredibly sexy. He was deceptively playful. But more than anything else, Ranger reeked of bad boy. It would take a lot more than a cashmere sports coat and an Armani tie to offset the testosterone and male pheromones that leaked out of Ranger. I doubted Ranger would ever be entirely respectable.
"Okay," Ranger said. "I admit respectable was a stretch. How about successful?"
"Yes," I said. "You look very successful." He helped himself to fruit and a slice of the frittata.
"I'm going to make a deal with you. The deal is that you work with me on the Dickie thing, and you don't go off on your own."
"That's the deal?"
"The alternative is that I lock you in my bathroom until I get this mess figured out."
"What about you? Are you going off on your own without me?"
"No, I'll include you in everything."
"Deal."
"Gorvitch, Pediak, and Smullen all have legitimate addresses, but none of them spend any time at them. And they don't spend a lot of time at the office downtown. I had someone search the three residences, and he found nothing. No computers, no clothes in the closets, nothing in the refrigerator. We've been calling their phones and only get a message service, never a call back."
"Lula and I went through the law firm's building on Jewel Street and discovered Smullen was keeping a woman on the top floor. The woman said Smullen lived there when he was in country. He was missing in action when we got there, and his girlfriend was angry. I should check to see if he's still missing." I took a bagel and loaded it up with cream cheese. "Why don't these guys live in their houses?"
"Maybe they're worried an unhappy client might come calling. I've been looking at the material you lifted from the law office. Rufus Kane paid the firm a little over $1 million last year for legal services. I thought we might want to talk to him."
You couldn't be associated with crime in Trenton and not have heard of Rufus Kane. Vinny had never bonded him out, so everything I knew was secondhand. And what I knew mostly was that he wasn't a nice guy.
"Rufus Kane is Middle Management Pharmaceuticals. Will he talk to us?"
"I have a relationship with Rufus.
He lives and works out of a slum apartment building behind the train station. I thought we'd pay him a visit this afternoon.
In the meantime, I have your FTA, Stuart Hansen, ready to go.
Call the control room when you want him brought down to the garage. I'll send one of my men with you, but you probably don't want to involve Range Man in the delivery.
Ranger finished his coffee and pushed back from the table.
I have to run.
Hansen was in the back seat of a Ford Explorer, physically ankle chained to the floor, mentally floating in la-la land. Ranger hadn't been kidding when he said they'd been keeping Hansen happy. Hard to tell if Hansen was in this euphoric state from too many episodes of Scooby-Doo or too much wacky tobacky. I parked the Explorer in the public lot across from the courthouse and unlocked Hansen's ankle shackles. His hands were still cuffed behind his back, and I had to help him out of the SUV. Ranger's guy was in the front passenger seat looking nervous, not sure how much help he was supposed to give me and still stay politically correct. I'll be back, I told the rangeman guy. Don't go anywhere. I maneuvered Hansen into the building, stood in front of the docket lieutenant, and Hansen started yelling.
Shit, the docket lieutenant said. Time I was that happy, I was in charge of the evidence room and we just busted a gangbanger carrying a suitcase full of medicinal weed.
I completed the paperwork, got a body receipt, and called Connie and told her Hansen was in the lockup in case someone wanted to spring him again. Ranger had said he'd be busy until noon, and it was still early, so I jogged to the SUV, got behind the wheel, and drove to Coughlin's house. Ranger had made me promise to work with him on the Dickey thing. He hadn't said anything about my FTAs. Small detour, I said to the rangeman guy. What's your name?
Brett.
He didn't look like a Brett. Guys named Brett were supposed to have a neck. This guy looked like he should be named Grunt.
I parked at the curb and had Brett follow me to the door. Brett was wearing a full utility belt with gun, stun gun, a can of pepper spray that could take down a grizzly, and cuffs. He was dressed in range man SWAT, and he was scary looking as hell. My intent was that Coughlin would see Brett with me and keel over in a dead faint before he got to fire off the shotgun. I knew Coughlin was home. I saw him moving in the glassed-in front porch just before parking. I hadn't heard the car leave from the backyard. I rang the bell and listened for the car. If I heard the car engine catch, I'd take off and run him down at the cross street. I rang the bell again. Brett was close behind me at the ready.
Should I break the door down?
No, I said. It's probably not locked. Brett stepped in front of me and tried the door handle. He pushed the door open and stepped inside and bang! Brett was covered in funk and short, mousy brown hairs. Hard to tell what the creature had been. I was guessing 60-pound rat.
What the?
Brett said. It's getting old, I yelled into Coughlin's house. I'll be back. I led Brett to the Explorer and drove him back to Range Man.
What is this stuff on me?
He asked.
What happened?
I think you might have been beavered, but there's no way to know without DNA testing. I walked him upstairs to the control room and turned him over to Hal. Down the hall, Ranger stepped out of his meeting and glanced my way. It wasn't my fault, I said to Ranger. Ranger smiled and returned to his meeting. Ella brought salad and sandwiches up at noon, and Ranger strolled in minutes behind her. How'd the meeting go? I asked him.
Good.
He selected a sandwich and ate it standing up in the kitchen. I did the same.
I notice you're dressed in rangeman colors, Ranger said to me.
Turns out I have clothes in your closet.
More than just underwear and socks, Ranger said. They were left from the last time you stayed here.
Does that make us a couple?
Spend another night with me and I'll explain couple to you, Ranger said.
I was tempted to ask him how we'd spent the last night, but thought maybe it was best not to know. I'd gone to bed alone and he was up and dressed when the alarm went off. I was telling myself he'd slept on the couch. That was my story, and I was going to go with it.
He removed his tie and unbuttoned his dress shirt, and I managed to stop myself from dragging my tongue down his chest to his belt buckle. I conjured the image of Morelli in my kitchen and told myself it wouldn't be a good idea to spend another night here. Ranger disappeared into his dressing room, and when he returned, he was in cargo pants, t-shirt, and cross trainers. His gun was clipped to his belt. He grabbed our jackets and hats from the coat closet. His hat said SEAL, and mine said Range Man.
Let's roll,
Ranger said.
We were in Ranger's Turbo parked on Ellery, looking out at the pathetic apartment building where Rufus Kane conducted his business. Other buildings on the block were graffiti decorated, but Kane's building was unscathed. It was four floors of eroded red brick and peeling paint trim, and the front door was missing. "Are you sure you want to leave the Porsche here?" I asked Ranger. "What are the chances it'll be here when we come back?"
"Chances are good. Only a dealer would leave a Turbo sitting out here in front of Kane's building, and no one wants to steal that car. No one wants that kind of trouble."
We left the car and stopped at the stoop to the building. The tiny foyer was littered with used condoms and syringes and what I hoped was dog poo. Ranger scooped me up and carried me to the stairs.
"This way we only have one pair of shoes to throw away," he said.
We hiked to the fourth floor, and Ranger knocked on the door.
"Yeah?"
came through the closed door to us.
"Who's there?"
"Ranger."
The door opened, and a toady looked out at us.
"Who's she?"
he asked Ranger. Ranger didn't say anything, and the toady backed up and opened the door. There were four people in the room, three goons and Rufus Kane. Easy to tell Rufus. He was a 200-pound, 5'5" guy having a midlife crisis, all decked out in jewelry and hair plugs. He was on the couch with a napkin daintily perched on his knee and a glass of champagne in his hand. There was a mound of sandwiches on a large plastic takeout platter on the coffee table in front of him.
"I was having lunch," Rufus said to Ranger. "Help yourself." "I just ate," Ranger said, "but thanks."
Rufus eyeballed me like I was dessert.
"Who's your bitch?"
"This is Stephanie," Ranger said. "She's running relief for Tank."
"I didn't know you and Tank had that kind of relationship," Rufus said.
Ranger didn't smile.
"So, what's up?" Rufus asked.
Ranger didn't say anything. He just stared at Rufus. Rufus made a little flick with his hand, and the three idiots left the apartment.
"Sit,"
Rufus said to Ranger. Ranger sat, and I stood. I was the muscle in the room.
"I'm thinking about retaining some counsel," Ranger said. "I'm looking at Pediak, Smullen, Gorvitch, and Orr." "Good firm," Rufus said.
"Why is it good?"
"Discreet, got a good business ethic."
"And?"
"Understands the barter system. You sure you don't want a sandwich?"
"I want to know more about the barter system," Ranger said.
"Why?"
Ranger didn't say anything. He didn't blink. He didn't smile. He didn't sigh. He just silently stared at Rufus.
"Good thing I like you," Rufus said to Ranger, "because you could have